This is intercultural yoga. Hello, my name is Raymond Reyes. I'm the Associate Provost and Chief Diversity Officer at Gonzaga University, and also your host for the Intercultural Yoga Podcast Program. This is a program where we talk about the issues that make us uncomfortable, but yet in that space of discomfort is an opportunity for growth and development. Today, I have two guests that I'm very excited about getting to know more and be able to talk about these issues of diversity, inclusion, and equity. First, I have Haley Wilson, a senior who's majoring in business and English, is also the diversity chair for the Gonzaga Student Body Association, and just an overall wonderful senior going out in a full blaze of glory with her activism and her commitment to social justice. I also have Izzy Carranza, who is a law student and what they call an L3. He's going to graduate very soon with his doctorate in law. And he's also very active in the law school. I see him in meetings here again around justice, inclusion, and equity. Today, I want to talk about change. The year 2020 has been quite a fascinating year in so many different ways, on so many different levels, physically, emotionally, mentally, and spiritually. It's almost been almost a rites of passage collectively for the 7.8 billion people that live on this planet, and more particularly those that are part of the Gonzaga community. Here's the dilemma for both of you. And this is what I've learned recently, you know, it's almost a catch-22, damned if you do and damned if you don't. I get the idea that students are tired. They're world weary of talk. They're tired of talk and they want action. But yet you have to have conversation and to communicate to come up with any solidarity, any agreement, any call for action. But yet it's almost this dilemma of you can't get a job without experience and you can't get experience without a job. You know, the chicken or the egg kind of dilemma. In this area where the students begin using rhetoric like demands, you know, demands require negotiating almost a minimal amount of facilitated communication compared to talking about issues together as a community for being in the solution space. Now, I understand the rhetoric of demand. I understand it gets your attention, but it is adversarial. And then also the idea of being too tired to talk, no more talking. All we want is action. And maybe you've heard me say this before. It's the old Emerson line that goes something to the effect that I can't hear your words over the loud roar of your actions, or the notion, you know, if necessary, always preach the gospel, you know. So how do we reconcile that? On one hand, the tensions around students not wanting to talk anymore to administrators, all they want is action, versus the need for conversation to agree on what will be done so accountability can be put in place. Does that make sense? That catch-22 that I'm attempting to describe?
It does, and you know what comes to mind is that idea of the same people are in the room, right? Like the same people who are tired of talking are the ones who are always talking. Mm. And it almost kind of brings up this idea of, well, how do we get the whole community to talk? You know, talking is powerful. And as you guys may be familiar with Bell Hooks's theory as liberatory practice, which I find myself going back to a lot this year, which is just the idea that like theory and conversation and consciousness raising can be healing, it can be liberatory. And so not anti-talking in any means, but at the same time, if we have the same people, you know, echoing back to one another, or the same people trying to get engaged with admin in the same way, and then, you know, quite frankly, getting burnt out aggressively every year over and over again, you know, the real question is, well, how do we get everybody involved in that conversation? How do we get everybody to buy into this idea of the power of talking as a thing that is actionable in and of itself, right? And not just students, but how do we get faculty and staff and admin those conversations too, right? I think that's something that's important and powerful and is kind of sequestered to certain groups, but really shouldn't be.
So one of the demands, as you know, from Black Student Union is to convene a town hall. So hopefully the town hall is an idea to expand the circle of conversation. I don't know, we'll see. But I guess the question I have is, given the 3 years, or almost four years that you've been here, Haley, and 3 years, Izzy, do town halls work? Are they effective at Gonzaga as part of our culture? Do we need to do something different? How can we expand beyond the choir and the usual suspects, or the converted, as they say, where, like you said, Haley, and rightly so, it's the same people talking to each other. And, you know, at a predominantly white institution, usually it's communities of color and students of color, Black, Indigenous, people of color, who are facilitating and leading these conversations, or at least inspiring and motivating them to occur. When, you know, what about the other, you know, 75% or other 70% of white majority? How do we engage them more fully into this work?
You know, I think that at least it's interesting that we're having these conversations right now here on the podcast, because I feel like this is a lot of the same conversations that I've been having at the law school. And I'm sure that it's, you know, motivated by a lot of the same issues that I see my colleagues in the undergrad level dealing with. And I think that's the trick. I think I really like how Haley described that, you know, like that we shouldn't wait for these crises to come up for administration to be looking for students to be like, okay, so how should we proceed? My question is, you know, why haven't these conversations just been continuing, and why is it that, like, all of, if there is some sort of you know, institutional knowledge that these issues have been pervasive for a while now and they're not new, why are we having these conversations as if they were new now? And I think that's sometimes what frustrates some of the students, at least some of my friends that I've talked to about it, is that then at that point when we are asked to have a conversation, then it feels like it's more of a, you know, trying to kick the ball down the road so that we can, or can down the road so that we can kind of avoid taking action. So I think that kind of leads into this idea of like, we don't want to just hear talk. We want some actionable steps. But I think if like what Haley said, if we have these conversations and we are continually doing this in a proactive way, I think that it has a lot more power. Not, you know, having conversations during crisis doesn't have power, but I think it will, at least from the student perspective, look like it's not just a way to, like, you know, calm our concerns down and then not being followed through with some actionable steps. So I think that that's kind of like a mix of what we've been seeing. And it's funny you mentioned, you know, the what came first, the chicken or the egg kind of thing, because I feel like that's kind of what we've been dealing with. Like, how can we have these actionable steps that take the students into consideration if we don't talk to the students and the students don't want to talk? So I think that at some point, especially in a crisis, like the things that we're dealing with now, we have to have these conversations, but then also keep in mind that we have to continue to have the conversations and not wait for crisis to bring us all together and to find these solutions. Because as Haley mentioned, like, a lot of us, you know, we live with this every single day in just smaller scales.
Well, and if I can add to that, I was just going to say that sometimes after like a crisis, there can pretty quickly be this consensus like, oh, why are we still talking about this? And I'm not saying that's what's happening right now, but I can kind of sort of think of a moment. I used to be in the comprehensive leadership program where something like happened to one of our students of color, and it kind of created this mass conversation about diversity and inclusion in the leadership space. And there was a lot of contention in the program following that, because a lot of people were like, well, why are we still talking about this? Didn't this get resolved? And then a lot of other people, notably the marginalized students in that cohort, were like, no, it hasn't been resolved. Like, we have to keep talking about it. So kind of Izzy, to the point that you were just reiterating, like, conversations regarding diversity and inclusion need to be going on really all the time, because there's always things that can be, you know, done better, and different ways in which we can view, you know, oppression and discrimination occurring in our university or like in our communities and whatnot. But that is sort of a barrier we have to get over, is that like, well, are we only going to talk about it when something really bad happens? And then how long are we going to care about it, right? But, you know, if we see that kind of happening from the admin and from the students on both sides, then I think town halls are a great way to do that, because you finally sort of get exposure to other groups. You know, as a student, maybe you finally understand the faculty or the staff perspective that you didn't understand prior. I think that's one way in which you can kind of engage the community to see the same problem in a different light, and sort of see how there's other existing tangential problems.
No, points well taken, both of you. In fact, Haley, I distinctly remember the comprehensive leadership program incident that you're referring to. I was consulted on that, and I always thought that there was an interesting perspective with the white majority students saying, are we still talking about this? And then other people saying, it's an eternal conversation, it never ends. And being able to put perspective on that diversity, and you've heard this before, it's almost trite to say, it's a bumper sticker I saw one time, diversity is a journey, not a destination. So it's not something you can check off the list. It's something that needs to be talked about constantly, because it's around us all the time. Both of you said something that got my attention, and I just want to explore it a little bit deeper. Maybe you've heard this story before. It's not going to be as long as the 100th monkey story, okay? So don't worry about that. But it's a story that goes like this. There's a man, and he's pulling bodies out of a river, almost the Spokane River is what I visualize. And there's bodies floating in the water, and he's pulling bodies out, and a man comes up to him and he says, what are you doing? And he goes, well, I'm pulling these bodies out of the river. And he says, well, why don't you walk further upstream and find out why they're falling in the water, why they're falling in the river? And it says, sometimes we react to effects and we don't go further upstream to actually directly confront or address causation. In this work of inclusion and equity, I'm wondering, you know, if we look at the overwhelming context of hundreds, if not thousands of years of racism and sins of omission based on human difference, that we operate in a larger context that many times is used to minimize, rationalize, and belittle the importance of our local dynamics. And so, is there such a thing, going back to that magic sauce, is there such a thing going into the causation of racism, of any kind of exclusion, that we can begin working smarter and not harder, and be able to identify the key leverage points in structures and societal systems that would allow us to minimize the effects of exclusion? Am I making sense, this idea here again of causation versus effect? Models of success in being able to do that, knowing what we're for, not necessarily always focusing on what we're against. Any reflections in that context?
I think I have something to add, and it kind of also goes back to your question about like, are town halls effective? And I think that focusing on the causation piece, I think that town halls, when done correctly, can be effective, especially from a student's point of view, because I think, you know, a lot of the times we see the outcomes of what, you know, racism looks like, and we're sometimes, you know, directly affected by it, but we don't always understand, especially like it, let's say at our school, we don't always understand the history of how we got to where we are now, and we also don't always understand the structures and the hierarchies that are at play. And I think that in town halls, some of those hierarchies, sorry about that, some of those hierarchies get deconstructed, and we start to see, for example, one of the things that I've been learning recently is just points of view from the faculty and staff, and understanding that there are barriers for them, to where sometimes we ask like, well, why aren't you acting? Why don't you do something? And I started to understand that there's, you know, struggles within that group of stakeholders that they have to address, and that aren't always visible from the student's point of view. So I think that one, the town hall meetings can, you know, put light on that, but then too, it can also help students just understand really where we're at.
That makes sense. That's helpful. And you helped me work through this idea that when I'm seduced by wanting to understand cause and effect, I'm really assuming that it's a linear phenomena. And maybe the intercultural relationship or the intercultural encounter is not linear, but it's circular and seasonal, and it's rhythmic, like the changing of the seasons. You know, it might just be a different way of thinking about the human experience in relationship as it pertains to human difference, whatever the social identity is. Because it seems to me that right when you are certain that you can succeed in making an adjustment in one regard, you might have a challenge, for example, in gender or national origin or social economic. So it's race as the foundational piece because of the history of this country, I believe, but yet there's other implications in terms of the other social identities. And the other thing I wanted to reflect upon that you activated in me, both of you, is this idea sometimes that process is an outcome. Let's not diminish the high impact of relationship and conversation and community and sense of belongingness. And that sometimes instead of being a human doing, we're called to be a human being. And what does that mean as a Jesuit Catholic humanistic university? How do we call forth the humanism that we're about in terms of being a human being and not always feeling we have to fix something, we have to do something? It might just very well be a process of evolution in relationship with each other as we experience community together, the good, the bad, and the ugly of that, and have the courage to face the things that are disruptive or divisive, make us feel uncomfortable. Productive discomfort has been the term used many times. So I appreciate many of the perspectives that you've offered. Let's go back to something though. It's interesting. People either focus on what they're against or what they're for. You know, Malcolm X versus MLK. I mean, Malcolm was very clear about what he was against. Martin Luther King, maybe a little more balanced diet between what he was against, but certainly what he was for in terms of his articulation of the beloved community. Are there models, are there sources of hope that kind of demonstrate when people do certain things, it results in anti-racism or what it means to be an anti-racist? I kind of want to venture a little bit in our conversation in that direction right now. Is the movement, especially after the George Floyd murder, people more focusing on anti-racism, being an anti-racist, versus focusing on racism and racist, wanting to adopt the practices and principles of being an anti-racist as a way to dismantle white supremacy? Any reflections in that regard? Models of success, what does it look like when everything works? Anything you've read, anything that you've heard, it could be matters of fiction, fantasy. I mean, really looking aspirationally for some models of success. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and I don't know if I could impart like a stringent model of success, but, and help me out, Raymond, what's the name of the man who does a lot of academic work on anti-racism and who coined the term?
Kendi, yeah.
Mm-hmm. We listened to, I don't know, in one of my classes, we sort of listened to him speak, and he was very particular about saying that anti-racism, the word itself is like an active kind of term, and that this idea of allyship or this idea of being an anti-racist is exactly like what you were saying about a human being, right? It's all about the process and kind of like this lifelong journey. I mean, you know, everyone's been socialized in their own unique ways to hold and have and internalize certain beliefs and opinions and values and whatnot. But I think what he's really calling attention to is this idea that you can't just sort of wake up and roll over one morning and like be an anti-racist, that you're constantly working every day and in every moment to be an anti-racist. And it's something about creating that mindset where that process is okay. And it's okay to sort of make mistakes and sort of stumble along the way. But the whole idea is you're not sort of stuck in this one mindset. You're always kind of working. So I guess that's kind of a model that I can think of that some people maybe don't recognize as much, is that it is all about constantly working and learning from all the experiences that you have.
No, I really appreciate that. One of my favorite quotes, excuse me, by John Lewis, he says, excuse me, he says the following. He says, "Freedom is not a state, it is an act. It is not some enchanted garden perched high on a distant plateau where we can finally sit down and rest. Freedom is the continuous action we must all take, and each generation must do its part of to create an even more fair, just society." So it's a verb. It's an act. It's not a state of mind. It's not a state. So consistent with, you know, how do we every day hold ourselves accountable for walking the talk and doing what Cornel West says, closing the gap between rhetoric and reality, between tracking hypocrisy, basically. As they say in London, when you're riding a subway, mining the gap, what is versus what should be. And I think that students like you at Gonzaga University are precisely that. You're guardians of a social consciousness. You assist this institution to have fidelity to its professed mission statement. This is who we say we are, but what's the Gonzaga experience? And how does Gonzaga in a larger communal context contribute to these ways of being and knowing that create community? I wanna trace back to this idea of hope. We have a few more minutes left, and we live, I think, in some dark times, some challenging times, and a lot of transition going on. Either professionally or personally, what are your sources of hope? What keeps you resilient? What keeps you hopeful? What are your sources of hope? I'm just curious, what keeps you going? What keeps putting wind in your sail? What keeps you inspired and motivated and passionate about who you are and what you do? Because I know both of you in that way. That's why I love working at a university with young people, because they naturally hold themselves in the world that way. People criticize young people of being, well, the idealism of the youth. We need the idealism of the youth. It could very well be our source for hope. So my question is, talk to me about hope. Actually, it's not even a question. It's a statement, isn't it? What is your source of hope? There's the question. What is your source of hope? What fuels your cultural resilience? This line that says, why is it that some people swim in the same waters in which others drowned? Which is a way of thinking about resilience, I guess. What is your source of hope?
I think I can go in on this one first. I think for me, my source of hope is that, well, my family first, and then my faith. But I think that kind of, to go into that a little bit more, is that I think that if hope is part of the human experience. I think for me, there's a lot I look at for symbols or things that symbolize hope for me. And for me, like being at Gonzaga is hope, because, you know, I wasn't always on this path to become an attorney. And I went down the wrong path for a couple of years, and for the longest time, that according to I think everybody that saw me, there was no hope. But I couldn't lose that, and I think that, you know, Gonzaga, I mentioned to you this before, but I feel like Gonzaga took a chance on me, and for me that's a symbol of hope, is that there's a lot of things that are wrong. There's a lot of things that could be better. And there's a lot of, strides that we have to make as people or as an institution at Gonzaga. But that is what gives me hope, that, even with all the, you know, shortcomings that our institution has, it took hope, it took a risk on me. And now it's given me an avenue to where I can pursue my career and then I can help others. And I think that for me, just keeping that hope alive and knowing that there is, even though it's difficult, that there's a possibility for change is what motivates me and keeps me going.
Yeah, and I can add, I mean, I think you're totally right, Izzy, like hope is part of the human experience. And I think just being in the position I've been in this year, which has been really hard in lots of moments, is that there's always people who are there when you make a mistake and who still care. Or if you don't feel motivated, there's people who do feel motivated. Or if you feel motivated, there's always people who are ready to listen and to get motivated with you. I think community is huge because like no one is capable really of solving anything without others. And I think kind of the beauty and difficulty of Gonzaga's campus is, you know what, we are a community and that there are lots of people who are passionate and hopeful about things. And no one is ever going to have full steam ahead 100% of the time, but there's always others. And I just think that's huge, right? Being in community with one another.
Well, that was very, thank you for both of you for that. That gives me interesting insight into hope, because I think that Izzy, you identified, in my sense, my interpretation, that hope has responsibility attached to it to some degree, even though the sources are family and faith. And then Haley, just the unconditional acceptance that you describe in hope is powerful. We're coming to an end here. I want to read something to you, because I think that both of you are visionaries. Both of you are dreamers. And I came across this, I've been reading some stuff about Harriet Tubman. And this is a quote from her that I just want to read a little short reflection. The quote goes like this: "Every great dream begins with a dreamer. Always remember, you have within you the strength, the patience, and the passion to reach for the stars to change the world." And then the reflection is, have you ever thought that how powerful a dream or a divine idea can be? I think that people like Harriet Tubman, who in the face of suffering and Hoferic slavery that brutally scarred millions in America, captured a divine idea. This idea led her to a place of strength that few can ever reach. And as I think about this, and her level of faith, belief, courage, and vision is one of the most incredible testimonies and testaments of the human spirit, a testament to a divine idea planted in the fertile soil of the soul. And then I just end with, how will you act upon the divine idea that you have within you today? And so I want to thank both of you, Izzy and Haley, for giving our listeners, for giving me, for giving the Gonzaga community a sense of hope, for sharing your passion, your vision, for not only what you're currently experiencing and making sense of, but moving forward into your future. Any last words of wisdom from either one of you? Because I would like you to have the last word, not me. Because I'm going to pass the baton to you as the younger generation. One word. How do you feel right now? Give me one word.
Well, I guess the word is hopeful. I had a proverb that I wanted to share, if that was okay.
Please.
So the proverb says, when justice is done, it is a joy to the righteous, but terror to the evildoers. And I think that's one of the things that, you know, keeps me going. I want to be a source of terror to the evildoers.
Yeah, or to love them in a way that motivates them to want to change, right?
That as well, yes.
Yes, that's beautiful. Haley, how about you? Any final words?
I mean, I think you guys sort of hit the nail on the head, and I'm just thankful to be here with you all.
Oh, thank you. And there you have it, Haley and Izzy, on this fine day in Spokane, Washington. Thank you for listening. Look forward to the next conversation on intercultural yoga. Have a good day. Blessings.